perhaps even a worse avera in a certain sense than lashon hara, or at least as bad, and certainly it would seem in many circles at least as commonly violated, is the avera of hona'as dvarim. And sometimes we don't give enough attention to the avera of hona'as dvarim, and what exactly that means, what its limitations are, what we are and are not allowed to say, and just how sensitive we have to be to other people. The Mishnah Berurah points out, in Chafetz Chaim's other sefer, the Mishnah Berurah, in Siman Shin Mem Gimel, Mishnah Berurah points out that there are several averos that one has to be very, very careful to train children from a very young age, because if they're not trained at a very young age to behave in certain ways, it's going to be a habit that's going to be almost impossible for them to change later on in life. I mean, there are a lot of things that they will be able to change later on in life. If a kid has trouble, he doesn't like wearing tzitzis because for whatever reason, he'll be able to change that. He'll start putting on tzitzis and eventually he'll do tshuva and he'll start doing the right thing. People will be able, if a person doesn't like to eat matzah, he'll grow up, he'll be able to eat matzah as long as he decides he wants to be Oved Hashem properly. But if a person trains himself to speak a certain way, because what distinguishes a human being from animal life is that we are medabrim. The Gezari talks about the different levels of bria, and above a bal chai is a medaber, is that a human being is able to speak. Of course, above a regular medaber is a Yisrael. Klal Yisrael is considered to be an entire different level of bria, but that's what distinguishes humanity, is our ability to be medaber. So if a person trains himself to speak in a certain way at a young age, it's going to be very, very difficult to change later on in life. And therefore the Chafetz Chaim says we need to be very machbid already at a very young age, even before children reach the age of chinuch, before children reach the age of bar mitzvah, and certainly before we're fully into adulthood, to be very careful about speaking lashon hara, and to be very careful about speaking hona'as dvarim. And he points out that we're certainly familiar with legal systems that punish crimes of defamation and libel, and we certainly have that in the American legal system, but the Torah has a different geder. The Torah has a different threshold for what we allow and what's called libel, and what person is going to be responsible, the level of responsibility a person has to have over his mouth. The Torah in Vayikra, Perchafei Pasuk Yudzayin, is the source. It says, Lo sonu ish es amiso. So Lo sonu literally means, what does it mean, Lo sonu? You should, well, it literally means don't cheat somebody or, hurt somebody in some way. Don't harass somebody or cheat somebody. But the Gemara Bava Metzia, Daf Nun Chesam Beis, has an entire sugya where the Gemara understands that it's not only about financial corruption. It's not only about hurting somebody monetarily, it's about hurting someone verbally. And that's what we call onas devarim. And the Gemara goes a step further, and the Gemara says that not only does losonu mean both onas mamon and onas devarim, but onas devarim is worse than onas mamon in several ways. One way that onas devarim is worse than onas mamon is that when a person cheats somebody financially, monetarily, so he's robbed him from his bottom line, from his money, he's hurt his wallet. When a person cheats somebody verbally, when a person hurts somebody verbally, verbally abuses him, he really gets to the core of who the person is. Meaning when someone says something to me, you are stupid, you are ugly, you are this, so it gets to my very definition of who I am, of what I am. And that's much more painful than losing a few dollars out of my wallet. The Gemara also points out that if a person gains money dishonestly, if a person makes some money dishonestly, doing tshuva is not all that difficult. In fact, it's a mitzvah in the Torah. It's a mitzvah we try not to have to fulfill, but the mitzvah is ve'eshev ha'zeila. If a person stole something, he has a mitzvah saseh to return that which he stole. With onas dvarim, it's pretty much impossible. Because what happens? You say, I'm sorry, please forgive me. And the person, because they don't like that whole encounter and the awkwardness of having to deal with the encounter, just says, okay, I forgive you, just go away from me, I forgive you. And they don't really, and even if they really mean it sincerely, but the next time, you told them that they're stupid, the next time someone tells them that they're stupid, they're going to think, wow, everyone thinks of me this way, and it's going to come back. Well, you said those words are never going to actually disappear. So, in fact, the Gemara in today's Daf Yomi, we learned it yesterday, the Gemara tells the story of the, who was it, Rabbi Elazar Rav Shimon, I think it was, that, what? Yeah. that had learned Torah from his Rebbe, and he was riding on a donkey, and he was feeling all proud of himself. And this relates to gaiva, which we're not really speaking about now, but he felt a sense of pride, he felt a sense of gaiva. And as we were discussing in the Orchel Sadiqim Shir the other day, when a person feels a sense of gaiva, it may only be Bein Adam La'atzmo, but ultimately it's going to express itself in a Bein Adam La'chaveru. It's going to be very hard to keep it Bein Adam La'atzmo. So if a person feels a sense of superiority, so here he was, he just learned Torah from his great Rebbe, so he's feeling good about himself. And, you know, a person feels, you sit in Beis Medrash all day, you feel good about yourself, you feel like, you know what, I've been learning strong, I've been doing well, you know, other people are not learning as well, they're missing Seder and they're missing Minyan, and I'm here and I'm strong and I'm doing and I'm, so you feel like I'm better than other people, and you start to feel a sense of Ram Levavcha, you feel a sense of Gaiva in your heart. And when a person starts to feel that way, ultimately it's going to spill out in the way he treats other people. So the Gemara says, it's mind-boggling, he felt a certain like shemitz of Gaiva well up inside of him, and he was riding on his donkey, and a man comes and says, Shalom Aleichem, Shalom Aleichem, Rabbi. And he looks at him and he goes, oh my God, you are ugly. Is everyone from where you live as ugly as you? And like, can you imagine like being a reasonably good person, let alone a holy Tano or Amora, and have those words come out of your mouth? You probably like are shocked even hearing yourself say it. Like, where did that come from? What did I just do? How did that even happen that I would say something like that? But he said it to this man, and both Rashi and Tosafot say the man was Eliyahu HaNavi, and the man says to him, really, I don't know if everyone in my town is as ugly as me, but if you have complaints, why don't you go to the one who made me and tell him that you don't like the job that he did and complain to him? And he realizes, I can't believe what I just said, and he gets off his donkey and he says, I'm so sorry, please forgive me, please forgive me. And he wouldn't forgive him. He wouldn't forgive him because we're dealing with Eliyahu HaNavi. And so why wouldn't Eliyahu HaNavi forgive him? You would think Eliyahu HaNavi would be the first one to forgive. No, perhaps he wouldn't forgive him because he was trying to show him that this is not something that's easily forgiven or even possible for a person to forgive. It's not something that's normal for a person to be able to forgive. Because you may forgive it and you may say, I don't care, it's fine, I'm mochel you, but ultimately it hurts too much. And ultimately it's still there somewhere deep down. So that's a second reason why Ona'as Devarim is worse than Ona'as Mamon. The Torah also says, when it comes to Ona'as Devarim, the Torah specifically says, V'yareisa me'elokecha. Why does it say V'yareisa me'elokecha? So the Gemara says in a couple of places that whenever we say V'yareisa me'elokecha, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying that there are certain things that you think no one will notice, but believe me, I know. I can tell the difference. See, when it comes to Ona'as Devarim, sometimes a person will say something to somebody and they'll be like, I didn't mean anything by it. I didn't mean it that way. I didn't mean to say, that you're ugly or stupid or whatever. I didn't mean it that way. I just meant that you're not as smart or good looking as me. I didn't mean it in any negative way. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu ultimately is the only one. If a person is Yiras Hashem, so he realizes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows the truth. The Marsha Maseches Bamitzia in the Chidush HaGadol in Daf Nun Ches Amud Beis says that the well-known Gemara considers a ganav, a thief who commits a crime secretly, to be worse than someone who steals in broad daylight. Why? Why is someone who steals secretly worse than someone who steals in broad daylight in front of everybody? Because he shows that he's not afraid of Hashem. The person who steals in broad daylight fears nobody. He doesn't fear God, he doesn't fear man. So it's not a blatant disrespect to God. He's not treating God as lower than man. But someone who steals under the cover of darkness is stealing because he's saying that I'm afraid of man, I don't want to be caught. But God, he doesn't think God is watching him, he doesn't care so much. So the Marsha says someone who overcharges another person has done an avera that anybody could easily recognize. If you overcharge money, anyone knows what you did. You displayed disregard for both man and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because everyone will realize that you have done something. HaKadosh Baruch Hu obviously realizes what you have done, but when you speak in a hurtful way, or you intend to say something that will hurt someone, we'll give some examples later where it could very easily be covered up by a person saying, I really didn't know it was going to hurt him, or people might not even think you intended to hurt. I mean, sometimes you could ask a person certain questions or draw attention to certain things. I'll give examples now. For example, let's say you know that somebody doesn't know something, a certain topic, and you want him to look stupid and to feel stupid. So you ask him about that topic.
Now, it looks like you're just asking a simple question. I'm asking a simple simple halacha question, or a simple question in the Pshat and the Gemara. No, but what I'm really trying to do is I'm trying to prove to you that you know nothing. But you can't tell. You can't tell that that's what I'm trying to do. You know, you're in a yeshiva in one shir, and there's someone else in yeshiva in another shir, and you, Taina, that your Rebbe is the best Rebbe in the whole world, and he, Taina, that his Rebbe is the best Rebbe in the whole world. So you have to prove that everyone who's in the other shir knows nothing. So you go over and say, oh, what's Pshat in this Rashi? Yes, he doesn't even know Pshat in the Rashi, moron. Meaning, but no one would know. It just looks like you're asking for simple pshat. It looks like you're asking for something simple. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows. You could argue that the comparison is not 100% accurate, because when someone steals in secret, he's actively trying to avoid his fellow man. Someone who doesn't know Zdvarim is not purposely avoiding being seen by man. The nature of the sin just doesn't lend itself to people recognizing exactly what you're doing. But that's the Marsha's point. Also, another difference between Anas Dvarim and Anas Mamon is the Isser to cause someone emotional pain can be violated even without saying a single word. It's so severe and it's so easy to violate. It could be violated by rolling your eyes. It could be violated with a quick glance, a snort, you know, a sarcastic laugh. It could be violated in so many ways. Where you're just, essentially what I'm trying to say is the words Ona'as Devarim are really a misnomer. Because Devarim means words, and it doesn't have to be words. It means making somebody feel bad. One of the most amazing things about where we are, I don't know if you guys appreciate the overall environment of where we are. I'm so thankful to Rabbi Brazil that he made our Beis Medrash here and not downstairs, even though originally I wanted it to be downstairs in that big room where we could be away from everything and have air conditioners at work, and you know, like I thought it would be really, really great. But one of the things that, like, I'm so thankful that he insisted that it be here, where we can be seen and see what's going on around us, is the environment of this camp is one where, at least they're trying very hard that it should be, and with a great deal of success, where nobody is made to feel lower based on how they look, how they speak, who they are, who their friends are. That's the overall environment of that's the yesod of the entire camp. That's what this place is built on. That's very unusual. Let alone not only in camps come out impossible. You don't find it anywhere. But even in just environments in general, you don't find that. And that's an environment that's ripe for tikkun amidos. It's an environment that we should try to imbibe a little bit of it and be able to use that in our lives beyond Camp Keli. It's a really, really special thing. I know that I'm inspired each and every day. Onas Devarim also is, you know, we said in the Avavta L'Recha Kamoch Hashir last week, that Zeh Klal Gadol B'Torah, Sefer HaChinuch understands that what makes it a Klal Gadol B'Torah, anyone remember? No, that would be a nice one for me to ask. That it impacts so many other mitzvahs, exactly. That sometimes you have certain mitzvahs that aren't just a mitzvah, but they impact many, many other mitzvahs. So the After Le'ach Kamocha, for example, the Minchas Chinuch says, well, if you fulfill the After Le'ach Kamocha properly, you're never going to steal, you're never going to commit adultery, you're never going to, because anything that you're doing to somebody else that would be negative, you wouldn't do if you really loved everybody. Onos Tvarim is another one of those mitzvahs that really overlaps a lot with other mitzvahs. The Sefer HaChinuch in Mitzvah Shin Lamed Ches explains that Onos Tvarim is part of a broader obligation to not fight with other people, not argue with other people, maintain a sense of shalom with other people. Rashi suggests that if you give bad advice to somebody, so we know that's a different issur also, when you give bad advice, if you know that a stock is about to tank and you give someone advice to buy that stock, what avera have you violated when you do that? What did you say? Lifnei Iver, right? That's a blatant violation of Lifnei Iver. Rashi is also a violation of Anas Dvarim. It's a violation of both Lifnei Iver and Anas Dvarim. The Rambam in the seventh paragraph of Hosdeos makes the obvious connection between Anas Dvarim and Lashon Hara, that those also are very often go together and are violated at the same time. The Sefer HaChinuch in Mitzvah Reish Lamed Aleph says that when a person curses another Jew, that's an isser of Onas Tvarim, it's an isser of damaging another person. And that's also obviously another overlap with Onas Tvarim. What? I think onas dvarim is more of a ben adam lechaver in a way that person feels hurt. Lashon hara would be behind someone's back. Right,
I think.
So then, yeah, lechaver, yeah, I think so. Now, are there any exceptions? Is there anyone that it's mutter to speak badly? What? So the Ramah in Choshe Mishpat. You said you want the Choshe Mishpat. The Ramah in Choshe Mishpat, Siman Reish Chaf Ches. The Ramah gives two limitations on the Yisra of Anas Dvarim. First, the Ramah says that the Yisra is only for God-fearing people. There's no Yisra if it's not for a God-fearing person. So the Sma points out that because it says Es Amisecha, so Amisecha means Imcha b'Torah Mitzvos. That it has to be someone who's like you in Torah Mitzvos, but people who have no Yiras Shamayim and don't participate in learning Torah and doing mitzvos are not included in Onas Dvarim. So a lot of contemporary poskim sort of downplay that exception. They point out that, meaning we, you know, the famous Chazanish, the Chazanish writes that nowadays we don't have such a thing really as a mumar, we only have such a thing as a tinuk shenishba, because people who grew up without any sense of what it means to be Yirei Shemayim, meaning the idea of the Chazanish always struck me as weird, that, you know, we're just going to take people who don't believe anything and say, they're a tinuk shenishba. What do you mean? There are so many opportunities to learn. Why should everyone automatically be considered a tinuk shenishba? But we have to realize that the way people are raised sometimes. I was once involved in a kavura in a shiva house for a person who was a conservative Jew, nominally conservative Jew, and the family kept on asking about the halacha, but they never used the term halacha or requirement or mitzvah. They used the term they kept on saying custom. What's the custom? Even about things that are clear. Chiyuvim, because in certain circles, everything is taught as a custom. Everything is taught as, you know, if you feel like doing it, it's good. If you don't feel like it, like when that's the way you're raised, when that's that everything is voluntary, that there's nothing that mitzvah doesn't mean tzivui. So you're really a tinuk shenishba. It's not even that you haven't heard of things. You've heard of things and have specifically been told that those things aren't really required. I remember my wife once, when she was in college, was volunteering as a teacher in like a conservative Hebrew school or something, and she asked the shayla, and the administration of the school said you could teach them about the Jewish holidays, but because most of them don't observe them actually, just say everything is a custom. So she asked the shayla. She didn't feel very comfortable calling, you know, eating matzah on Pesach a custom. So, you know, not eating chametz on Pesach a custom. So she asked the shayla. She was told, absolutely not. It's a ziyuf haTorah. You absolutely cannot teach that. That's killing Yiddishkeit when you teach them that. That's the concept that people are a tinuk shenishba, but they really just don't know better. Many poskim extended even beyond that. Even people who were educated in yeshivos and do know better and were taught better. But some of the poskim view the Yetzer, I think Rav Sternbach writes like this, that the Yetzer Haras are so big out there that it's so, and it's so accepted, and it's so easy for a person to abandon a life of Torah and mitzvos and find his own community where he can live comfortably and find other people just like him, and that it doesn't have the same, it's not the same as it was in the times of Chazal, where if you're going to turn your back on Torah and mitzvos, you are going in the middle of nowhere. You are leaving Judaism entirely and the Jewish community, and you'll have no support, and your family's not going to be there for you, and they're going to tear Kriya and Sechiva, and, you know, you're not, it doesn't happen that way anymore. And because of that, maybe everyone is considered a Tinuk Shenishba. So generally speaking, even when dealing with the religious Jews, and perhaps even more importantly when dealing with the religious Jews, where we're trying to make a Kiddush Yom Shemayim, we're trying to show the way B'nai Torah deal and interact with people. The Rav Vosner points out in Shevet Alevi in Chelek Hei, Kudshus HaMitzvos, Osnun Aleph, that it's best for us to avoid any sort of Anas Dvarim with anybody. We wouldn't need Rav Vosner to tell us. Now, it's also interesting that this idea that it's mutter when it's someone who's not a ben Torah is not mentioned in the Rambam or Shulchan Aruch, even though it does appear in the Gemara. The Ramah didn't make it up. It's a Gemara, but the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch don't paskin like that. They don't mention it. Perhaps the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch understand that it only applies to someone that the Gemara limits the Isser to somebody who's with you as an additional warning to be careful not to insult your wife who is with you. Meaning maybe it relates to another line in the Gemara, which we'll get to in a second, that there's a specific heightened sensitivity that one has to have toward their wife. Yeah.
So you're talking about almost the arm. I mean, it's like, regards to like, we sometimes like shun people who knew what they did. Like, I talked to you the other day about it a few days ago.
Yeah.
Certain people. So, like, that be considered almost the arm, that be considered because they did something that's what they did.
No, when the community, there are two things. A lot of times in Judaism, there are competing principles. There are two things working against each other, and we have to figure out which is the dominant principle. So, for example, there is an Isser lo samar al dam re'acha, that you can't stand idly by and watch someone be mazik the entire community. So if you have someone who's in a position of authority, and you don't do anything about the fact that he's abusing people, let's say, so it may be hurtful to him to throw him out of the community or to spread the word about what he's done, but it's this of l'sam l'adam re'echa to protect innocent victims is much more critical. So a lot of times there are competing principles. If you have a specific case in mind, I'd rather not talk about that publicly. But if there's just broadly speaking, it's often that we're dealing with two competing principles.
Within that, like, okay, fine, now like people know whatever, but now like or aftermath that people still are like. Now it's
again, I get the sense that you have a specific case in mind, but that's the answer in broadly. The other thing to be cautious about is a lot of times we assume everybody knows, and a lot of times it's not the case, especially with a prominent figure in the community who likely has a lot of sympathizers. Because of all the good that they've done in the community, they're able to turn to people who will sympathize with them and won't believe it, no matter what you do. So it's really, really important then to remove that person from the community to save those people who innocently, to me, mistake, you know, really believe everything, that the person must be a great person and that it's all just vicious slander against them. If we need to protect them, then we need to protect them. But again, I'd rather not get into specific cases. We'll just speak broadly. Now, the Ramah's other exception to Onas Devarim is that Amar writes that you're allowed to do Onas Devarim on somebody who does it on himself, who verbally abuses himself. Like someone says, I'm such an idiot. Like you could say, yep. So the question is that true? Like, that doesn't sound right. If someone's putting himself down, you're allowed to just like join in and continue to pick on him with him. So it's a little bit puzzling. You know, you would think that somebody who suffers from such low self-esteem, that he's always putting himself down, Adrabi, you would need to build him up. You need to show him a little sense of more sensitivity and try to build his self-confidence. So the Sma, on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, in Choshen Mishpat, and Reish Chav Ches, it gives three possible explanations what this means. If a person is putting himself down, you'll have to know Stefan. First, he says, maybe he's talking about someone not who insults themselves, but someone who insults you. That it's a euphemism when the Ramah says someone who insults himself. It's like we call the Jewish people sometimes when they do something bad, Soneim Shal Yisrael, the enemies of the Jewish people, the haters of the Jewish people, when we just mean that we're our own worst enemy sometimes. So we don't want to talk about someone that he puts you down, so he says he's putting himself down. And there's a lot of there's a lot of insight into the euphemisms that Chazal use. You know, why do they refer to the Jewish people when we do Averus as Soneim Shal Yisrael, as the haters of the Jews? Why do you think they dafka do that? They could have referred to us as anything, to use the Lashon Sagi Nahar. Why is it dafka the haters of the Jews? Because ultimately, what?
That's what we want. They want our haters to be bad instead of us.
Oh, I mean, we wish it were the haters of the Jews. Yeah, one possibility. What? Yeah, meaning we're our worst enemies. We don't even realize, but we're our worst enemies when we're doing bad things. So we literally are Soneim Shel Yisrael. So perhaps the Ramah was speaking Lashon Sagi Nahar over here. Someone who puts himself down is actually referring to, says the Sma, someone who puts you down. But what's he really doing? When a person puts everybody else down, no one respects such a person. Ultimately, people just don't respect a person like that. A person who goes around speaking badly about other people and insulting other people. So what he's really doing is he's putting himself down. There's a certain insight into even the euphemisms that the Chazal use. So if a person is verbally assaulted, what the Sma says in his first interpretation is, if you're verbally assaulted, if you're verbally abused, you don't have to be like an Evan Domeim. You don't have to sit there like a silent rock. You can respond. You're allowed to protect yourself a little bit. Meaning a person does not have to be completely mevatel everything that comes in his direction. At a certain point, you could defend yourself. And the logic is that it might be that this is part of the last exception also, that by insulting you, he's showing that he's not es amisecha, he's not imcha b'torah mitzvos. So he's leaving himself totally open for verbal abuse. Now, if that were correct, though, it would turn out that it would just always escalate. Whenever someone insults you, you just yell back. And, like, that doesn't seem right. That doesn't seem like the Jewish approach. Meaning we do have a concept of vatranos, of being mevater, that when someone says something to you, just say, you know what, I'm bigger than that, I'm not going to respond, I'll let it go. And a person is mevater, it's a very great zechus, the Gemara says, to be mevater, that a Kodesh Baruch Hu is mevater on his, that a Kodesh Baruch Hu will be mochel his avonos. It's one of the etzos to be mezaka biyom adin, the Gemara says in Masecha Shabbos, is to be mevater, that a Kodesh Baruch Hu will look more favorably. So the second interpretation of the Sma says about this comment of the Ramah is that the halacha, of course, is talking to someone who insults themselves, like it sounds like. It's not talking about someone who insults you. But since it's usur for a person to put himself down, it's usur for a person to insult himself also. You know, like the story of the Chafetz Chaim. When the Chafetz Chaim was on the train and someone sat next to him, didn't know he was the Chafetz Chaim. He hadn't seen the picture, I guess, of the Chafetz Chaim. Or maybe he saw the picture of that guy with the payas that they have on the cover of all the books. So he had no idea what... What?
It is him.
That is not him. So they have no idea... No, it's not. So
they,
have you seen the actual picture of the Chafetz Chaim? There is an actual picture of the Chafetz Chaim. Yeah. So
like
they, so nothing like him. So he was sitting on the train. So this guy just has his lesson a day book of the Chafetz Chaim with a picture of him in the front, and he's looking at the guy next to him. You know, looks like a taxi driver. You know, the actual Chafetz Chaim doesn't look like this regal. You know, so and he starts saying, and then, you know, the Chafetz Chaim says, whose book is that? And he's like, oh, the Holy Tzaddik v'Chafetz Chaim. It wasn't really with the book, but I'm embellishing a little bit. The Holy Tzaddik v'Chafetz Chaim, this is his sefer, he's such a... And the Chafetz Chaim, you know, being an anav, said, he's not so great, he's not so special, he's not, you know, not so holy. And the guy said, what are you talking about? And he smacked him across the face. How could you talk that way about the Chafetz Chaim? And then they finally get to the town where they were going, and the holy Chafetz Chaim had arrived in town. So the whole city came out to greet him. And this guy realizes, who are they greeting? They're greeting the fellow that was sitting next to him. And he realized that it was the holy Chafetz Chaim. And he felt terrible. The Chafetz Chaim said, no, you don't have to apologize to me. You taught me a lesson in Lashon Hara, that you're not even allowed to speak Lashon Hara about yourself. It could be that there's nisa to put yourself down also, that a person should not constantly be putting himself down. Cheshbon ha-nefesh, yes. Thinking about where we can improve, yes. But needlessly insulting yourself and saying bad things about yourself, no, we don't really believe in that. So maybe by virtue of the person putting himself down, he is no longer es amisecha. And if he's no longer es amisecha, again, it fits into the first exception to the rule of anas tavarim. But the Sma rejects both of those interpretations, and he suggests a third interpretation of what the Rama means, and he says that it refers to someone who inflicts insults on himself, but he's simply not a normal person. It's not that he's a rasha or something, that's not a normal thing to do. And the Torah says that you're not allowed to abuse amisecha, which not only means observant people, it means people with a basic degree of sanity. And if he lacks that basic degree of sanity, then the Isser won't apply. Very troubling, no? You would think if he lacks that basic degree of sanity, so get him help. Adrabah, don't just pile on. If you pile on, it's going to make him worse. So this exception of the Ramah I have a lot of trouble with. I'm not really sure what to do with it. Black on white in Shulchan Aruch, I have no idea what it means. I have a lot of trouble with it. Sma has three explanations. I don't know if I'm really satisfied with any of the explanations. Another possible exception to the Isser of Anas Tavarim is if a teacher is trying to motivate a student. student says a pshat, Rebbe, what about this? Or you know, or so a student asks a question, let's say, and it's like totally off topic. It's got absolutely no. It reflects a complete lack of understanding of everything that they're doing. The teacher says it's got nothing to do with this. Now, how's that going to make the student feel? It will make him feel pretty terrible. But if that's the way to guide him and to show him how to think and to show him where to gear his brain, like the student asks, you know, these inane questions of, but what if, you know, and he comes up with his own case, you know, we've all heard these kinds of questions where he comes up with it. It's not about what if. Let's deal with the Gemara and try to understand the Svara over here. So it's okay for a teacher to say that to the student so that he can teach him how to think. In fact, it's critical to teach him how to think. Now, having said that, I've seen different styles in terms of this. They say Rav Soloveitchik in the old days used to be vicious. Used to you know, go after. That was the old Litvish Mahalik, that if you're saying a shir and a student says a bad svara, he says a svara, they think Rav Soloveitchik used to yell at him, Chaya, Shikara, Goy, you know, yelling at him with all sorts of names and telling him how terrible, you know, the svara was. There used to be a Rebbe in Yeshiva when I was in Keren B'Yavneh, Rav Dimmerman, who was a he was fire, and you know, he would pick up shtetlers and throw them, and he would throw things at the kids and throw things out the window, and, you know, like a madman, you know, bouncing up and down the room and screaming and yelling. And he's still I think he still gives shiurim in Rehovot sometimes. My grandfather sometimes goes. He says it's wild. It's just a show. It's even just like, you know, but that was the style. He's I think a Talmud of Shmuel Ruzovsky, I think. So he just, you know, wild, and he just, that was the style, that's the old Litvish style to do. And the point is to try to show people what the right way to think. Rav Dimmerman, they said once, one of my friends told me, one of my older friends who was in his shir, he had stopped giving shir already when I was in the shiva, I only give shir kali once in a while, told me that he was sitting there learning, looking inside the Gemara in the middle of shir, and Rav Dimmerman comes over to him and smacks him across the face. And he looks up and he says, what did I do? I was looking inside the Gemara. And he said, yeah, but that was for all the times you weren't. So, like, it's a different style. Now, on the opposite extreme, I spent a couple of years, I may have mentioned once or twice this summer, in Rav Shechter's here. And Rav Shechter, people, you might think, oh, Rav Shechter's shir probably has a lot of very good guys, and it does. There's a lot of very good guys in that shir. You know, some real all-stars used to sit next to me in shir. People who are Rosh Yeshiva and YU now, really, really phenomenal Talmid Chacham. And then there were some not such all-stars that would, you know, that would just, because it's Rav Shechter, so they wanted to be in the room. And they would just, like, raise their hand and ask, like, you know, he's in the middle of talking about Takfu Kohen or something, and they'll, you know, Rebbe, if you microwave your cat, do you then need to kosher the microwave after? Like, you know, like, just like something like ridiculous. And he would just patiently answer the question, no matter what. No matter what the person said, he would patiently answer the question. And that was his style. It could be that he feels that with a Yeridas Adoros that people can't handle it. It could just be that it's his personality. He's soft and he just can't. You know, doesn't like to make people feel bad, even in that context. But that is sometimes if it's a really ridiculous question where the question doesn't even make any sense, and he knows that it's not going to make sense, he'll just say like, I don't know.
So it
does seem that, now the Rambam writes in the fourth paragraph of the Talmud Torah that if a Rebbe is overly demanding, then it's very likely that he's going to be ineffective. Talmidim will very likely be turned off. The definition of an overly demanding Rebbe is someone who constantly berates students who simply can't understand the material. The students aren't strong enough, and he's berating them for not being strong enough. So a lot of times it's important for the teacher to realize that a lot of times if the students don't understand the material, it's not necessarily because the students aren't trying. It's not even necessarily because they're not smart enough. Very often it's because the teacher didn't do as good a job as he could have explaining it and making sure to explain it in enough different ways that the different types of students could understand it. There's one of my favorite studies that was done a number of years ago where they told first grade teachers that they have a very special group in their class of specially gifted students. And they did IQ tests on the kids before this, but they didn't actually give an accurate list of who the most gifted students were to the teachers. In fact, they just took a random selection of students and told the teachers in advance, we're giving you a very special pikadon over here. These are very gifted students. Make sure that you do a good job with them because they're extremely gifted. And the students were really quite average. and then they tracked how the students did in school over the next several years. And the numbers are just like off the charts. The discrepancy between those students and everybody else who started out the same as them, with the same IQs and the same type of family background and the same, just the fact that the teacher thought the student was gifted enabled the student to achieve at a much higher level for years to come, not just that year, even the following year and the year after, because a certain confidence was built in them and a certain expectation for themselves was built. But the idea is that the teacher, if that student fails, if that student doesn't understand something, the teacher's going to realize that it's his fault, that it's not the student's fault. And therefore, the teacher's going to make sure that that student will understand it and will do whatever he can. So that's what the Rambam's talking about. The Rambam says you're not going to be effective if you're just constantly demanding. But if the students are being lazy, and they're therefore not following the shir, or laziness doesn't always have to be in the shir. A lot of times a student will come to shir, Talmud will come to shir, and he'll want to learn, but the night before he decided to party till 3 in the morning. So he's not gonna be able to function properly. So it's not that right now he's being lazy, but he put himself in a bad position to be able to learn properly. So then the Rebbe has a right to do it. In fact, the Rambam says he's mechuyev to get angry at them and to humiliate them. If you look at that Rambam, it's startling, the Lashonos of the Rambam in the fourth paragraph of the Talmud Torah. He should humiliate them and get angry at them in order to sharpen them. That's the way we do it. And that was a fairly common thing. The Rambam says that if the Rebbe is going to be an effective intimidator, he shouldn't eat, drink, or laugh in front of his students. Definitely not wear polo shirts in front of his students. Now, the exact nature of a Rebbe Talmud relationship obviously is different, as I mentioned, with different Rebbeim. You look at Gemara sometimes, and you see how Amoraim interacted with each other, and like you ask yourself, like, were these nice people that they spoke in this way about each other? The Gemara in Yevama Staf Tes, Menachas Daf Pei, has Amoraim referring to each other as brainless. You have Gemara in Yevama Staf Chav Dalet, Nida Daf Samach, where they accuse each other of making halachic statements while half asleep, not in a complimentary way. They have Gemara in Erev and Daf Tes Vav. It's ki'ilu, you never learned a single word of Torah in your life, the way you're speaking. So, how are we to understand? That's in light of this Rambam, the Talmud Torah, maybe we understand it that way, that they're trying to sharpen each other. That's just the way, that's Esvehev Basufa, we just read in this past week's parasha, that the Gemara in Kiddushin says, that Shnei Talmidei Chachamim, that they become oivim, says that they become like, they're like enemies when they're fighting and learning, but they don't get up from the Gemara until they're ohavim, says that at the end of the day they're going to love each other at the end. Their love is only going to be increased by the fact that they had this shared experience of learning Torah together. Rav Shacht always likes to tell the story of the Talmidim and the Mir Yeshiva when they were going to Shanghai and they were on the train during World War II, and they had these giant Gemaras. You know, they used to have these very big Gemaras. So there was a non-Jew on the train with them who was recording like his experiences and what he saw from these Jewish students. And he wrote in his memoirs, they actually have the memoirs of this non-Jew, and he said, it's the oddest thing. They take out these giant books, and then they start yelling at each other and screaming at each other and berating each other, and they really, really hate each other. And then they close the books after several hours, and all of a sudden they seem like best friends. And he doesn't understand what's going on. But that's what the Gemara is describing, literally, as Vehev Basufa. That Chavrusa should be, with yelling, it should be passionate, it should be, you know, trying to get to the Emes. Now, it should be about trying to get to the Emes, not about trying to be right. That's a different shmooze. But at the end of the day, it creates a sense of Ava. There is a tshuva in the Chavis Yar in some Kufnin Beis, where the Chavis Yar goes through every insult in Shas, and he tries to show why it's really a compliment. It's not really an insult. He didn't mean brainless. He meant, you know, like, and he goes through how all of them could be a compliment. Very, very hard to really accept everything he says, that it's really a compliment. Another possible exception, the Gemara says that the Yisra of Ana'as Mamon doesn't apply to non-Jews. So what about Ana'as Dvarim? Is Ana'as Dvarim Mutra non-Jews? So Ruchim Fishel Perlau, in his commentary to Rasag Sefer HaMitzvos, Lo Sasei Pei Beis Pei Gimel, says that the Mishnah draws a link between Anas Mamon and Anas Dvarim. The Mishnah says, Kishem, that Anas Mamon is Aser, so Kach, Anas Dvarim is Aser as well. So, Lechora, the Gedarim should be the same, and therefore it should not apply to to Goyim. But even if it's not the formal Isra of Anas Dvarim, maybe an Isra of Chil Hashem, maybe several other Isurim. So it's not necessarily the Gemara and Brachas of Zayin and Beis talks about picking fights with Goyim. It may not always be wise.
Isn't there a lot of time to say nice things about
Lo Sichanim is an Isra in the Torah. Lo Sichanim, the Gemara of Avodah Zarah says, means three things. One of them is Lo Sitin Lanchein, which is what you're referring to, not to say nice things. But that's there's a difference between not saying nice things and saying mean things.
I think they'd be based on the same principle, right?
Not necessarily. Lo Sichanim may be more about that if you elevate him, you know, you put him on a pedestal and you have him be your role model. So then it's a concern that you'll end up wanting to be like that. But to just not say mean things, just don't be mean. You know, it's much, much easier just not to be mean. Neither the Rambam nor the Shulchan Aruch mention non-Jews as an exception to the Isra of Anas Dvarim. They both seem to assume that, you know, they don't mention. Now, it could be they don't mention because, in general, Mitzvah Peirah Mechaveiro apply to non-Jews or not? No, generally not. Mrs. Ben and Lechaver generally do not apply to non-Jews. Do we give tzedakah to Goyim?
After, only
for
with Jews together.
So we do it for Darkei Shalom. But technically speaking, Mrs. Ben and Lechaver don't apply to non-Jews. Another exception in Chaschinuch in Reish Lamed Aleph. What? Okay. The Minchas Chinuch in Reish Lamed Aleph says that the Isser of wishing bad things for people applies even when it's not just a person, it's an entire community. And you get, I don't know if there's an exception, I guess, when you get Malkus for cursing an entire community the same way you would for cursing an individual. In fact, the Rambam says that if you say bad things about an entire community, the Rambam has a fascinating parak in Hilchas Shuvah, the fourth parak of Hilchas Shuvah. I once gave a whole Shabbos Shuvah drasha about this. Fourth parak of Hilchas Shuvah is the 24 things, the Chavtal Dvarim Hamakvinus of Shuvah. 24 things you can't really do Shuvah for. Some of them you can't do Shuvah for because the Averos are just so overwhelmingly bad that there's no way to do Shuvah for them. Some of them you can't do Shuvah for because it's like the old mashal where you take a bag of feathers and you throw it off a rooftop on a windy day and trying to collect all the feathers afterwards, it would be impossible. That the impact is just so widespread that you would never be able to track down everyone that was hurt by it and actually get mechila. So this is one of them, meaning if you speak disparagingly about an entire community, about an entire country of people, oh, people from this town are so that, or are so this, or so rude, or so whatever the disparaging remark is, so now you're going to track down everyone from there and get, it's going to be impossible. So it's one of the things that we can't do tshuva. But more important, yeah? Chavos Halvavos says it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. Where did I just see a discussion of that? I just saw a discussion of that somewhere. Maybe the Sefer Kamotzei Shal Rav? I don't know. Kind of thing. I'm not sure.
Just about the guy, I'm saying, if we exclude the Jew who wasn't, you know, part of the Sefer.
Meaning that's why you wouldn't have an Isser, because we wouldn't want the Zechiyos transfer. Okay, maybe. Yeah.
Nicknames
are a form of Anas Dvarim as well. I could speak for an hour about nicknames, really. There's like we could speak for an hour about nicknames. My favorite halachic tshuva about a nickname is the guy who... The town where they had two people named Chaim, and one of them was short, one of them was tall, and they wanted to know if it's a problem to call the tall one Chaim Aruchim. I thought that was cute. You know?
But, the other one Chaim Katarim?
No, that would be not nice, but you know, it's called the tall one Chaim Aruchim. And there are Makoros and Chazal where they gave people nicknames also, but we could talk about Anas Dvarim for hours today if you want, but I figured like at some point you're going to want to stop talking about Anas Dvarim. I mean, I may have passed that point about 20 minutes ago, but... I'm in charge here. There are also lots of people that require extra sensitivity, and this is more important than the people who are the exceptions. People that Onas varim is bad when you do it to your friend or you do it to someone who's pretty much secure in who they are. Onas varim is much worse with several groups of people. Sefer HaChinuch in Mitzvah Samachay says that the Torah requires that we are more compassionate and kind to those who are weakest and most vulnerable in our society because they cannot stand up for themselves. I spoke in Camp Morashah last night to a group of counselors and I spoke about Onas varim, and I said to them that people who cannot stand up for themselves does not just mean people who are somehow incapable of proper speech and formulating thoughts. It could be people who are used to having someone to protect them, someone to look out for them, and now don't have that. Meaning, children who normally always look to their parents, who are going to protect them and will always have their back and will make sure that no one hurts them, and now are away from their parents for a month, for 2 months, and they feel it. They feel, even though they sometimes act tough or whatever, they feel it. They feel that they're away from their parents, and they feel that there's no one really that's watching out for them. So to pick on someone in that situation is even worse than to pick on someone in a situation where they know that they have a parent who has their back. That's one of the unique situations of just being in camp, being away from a parent. A lot of times, counselors forget what it's like for a child for a young child to be away from their parents. Just the other day, when my wife only came for Shabbos, but she's a long weekend, and then she went back. She has to work for a living. One of us has to. So as she was leaving camp on Sunday with my daughter. I'm like, I started getting that, like, that empty feeling at the end of visiting day that you get, like, I can't believe they're leaving. No, come back. You know you're having a great time, but you don't want to. And, like, you realize that's what kids feel. And if a kid is feeling that way in a much more, if a kid is feeling it more intensely, probably. And if a kid is feeling that way, then that's a very vulnerable position for a child to be in. The Gemara, however, specifically highlights, and this is an important shmooze that you should hear at this stage in your life, because it's going to be too late to hear it later. The Gemara in Masechet Bava Metzia specifically highlights that a person has to be very careful in the way that he speaks about in the way that he speaks to his wife. And the Gemara gives two reasons that a wife needs to be treated with extra sensitivity. Reason number one, the Gemara says, is dim'asa metsuya. She cries easily. Women cry more easily than men. There are exceptions to every rule. Some men cry easily. Mori Farabi, I have a Masorah from my Rebbe that, he cries easily. I cry pretty easily also, but not as easily as him. Because he's just a person full of regesh, so he's a very emotional person. He cries. His wife makes fun of him. She doesn't cry as easily as he does. So you have. It's not always true that women, but broadly speaking, women cry more easily, and because of that, one has to be very careful the way they speak to women. The other reason the Gemara says is that a person has to realize all the brachos that come to his house, everything that he has, all of his success, is by virtue of the akeras habayis, is by virtue of his wife. And it's a fundamental lack of akeras hatov to speak to his wife in a degrading manner if he were to really realize that everything that he has is only because of her and only through her, and she's the tzinor through which HaKadosh Baruch Hu provides bracha to his house. So then it's a fundamental lack of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to speak negatively to her. Now, nafkamina between the two is the heightened level of isur to any woman or just to your wife? If it's demasa metsuya, it would be to anybody. Now, especially your wife, because again, when one of the things that a person who feels persecuted always takes comfort in are those who protect them. Meaning a child who feels persecuted takes comfort in his parents. A spouse who feels that they're being disrespected, that being mistreated, let's say a spouse is being mistreated at work or something, the boss is mean or whatever, the spouse takes comfort in their spouse. They take comfort, and who are they going to take comfort with when their spouse is the one that's mistreating them? So it's a much higher level of anas tivarim when dealing with a spouse. And when I spoke in the Tivarye this year, I went to Eretz Yisrael and gave a shiur in the Tivarye. So I asked what they wanted me to speak about, so they said, Shalom Bayis, give a shmooze on Shalom Bayis. So I said, I didn't realize Shana Aleph guys are married in Tivari, it was Shana Bet guys. Shana Bet guys aren't married in Tivari either, but they, with tremendous chachma, they said, they need to hear it now, because if they hear it later, it's going to be too late. And it's correct. They need to hear it early on. And one of the points that I made, and I always make to Chassanim, is that a lot of times in the modern Orthodox community in particular, you know, people a lot of times think co-education is the greatest thing in the world, because how is a guy going to know how to talk to a girl if he doesn't have experience growing up talking to girls? And that's, you know, and that's why there's a shidduch crisis. Because I can't tell you how many times I've heard that from people. That's why there's a shidduch crisis, because guys never learn to talk to girls because they're not sent to co-ed schools and co-ed camps or whatever. There is a growing amount of research that suggests that a shidduch crisis would be more likely to be created by co-education than to be avoided by co-education. Why is that the case? Well, why is it worse? Why is it that you're in a worse position when you were in an environment where you've been around girls all the time as a child? Because our relationships as a sixth grader and a seventh grader and an eighth grader and a ninth grader and a tenth grader are on a very immature level. And if that's the stage in life that we learn how to relate to the opposite gender, then we're learning how to do it in the wrong way. And we need to unlearn it by the time we get married. Meaning a lot of times the way guys will flirt with a girl when they're in high school is by being mean to them. It's not just in five-year-olds in kindergarten where if he throws sand at her in the sandbox, that means he likes her. You know, in the more sophisticated version of that is the 10th grader who makes fun of the girl so that he could then have a four-hour conversation with her about what he, you know, about how sorry he is and whatever. And, you know, just and it's like this psychological mess that's created sort of on purpose that creates these very unhealthy ways of relating to people. And one has to be mechabed his wife, the Rambam writes. One has to honor his wife, and by honor means he can and one has to be very careful about the way he speaks to her. A lot of times amongst our friends, it's like accepted that we make fun of people and, you know, get a good laugh. You know, that if it's funny, that it's not an us dvarim, someone was saying before. So we sit around a table, and, you know, your wife did the most ridiculous thing. It was the middle of the night, and she started talking in her sleep, saying the most ridiculous thing. So you want to tell everyone at the table, because it was so funny how she did that, or she thought that, whatever. You tell everyone at the table, and she feels very hurt by that. Now, she may smile through it, she may not, or she may just, you know, not smile, but whatever it is. But that's not the way you talk to a wife or about a wife. It's if you want to make fun of somebody, make fun of yourself. You're a much better target than making fun of her. You're not supposed to make fun of yourself either, but it's better than making fun of a wife. So that's one person, one category of people that require a very high level of sensitivity. The other, a second, is children. The Rambam in Hilchos Deos writes in the sixth paragraph of Hilchos Deos that Onas Dvarim applies even to children, but it's not even to children. If you accept the Gemara's explanation by women that Dimasa Matsuya, that they cry easily, so children also cry very easily, and therefore it would mean that you need to have a heightened sense of Onas Dvarim dealing with children. Rav Palm's grandson told me that he was once walking with his grandfather. For some reason, I seem to remember him saying that he was walking with his grandfather in a mall, but I find that very hard to believe. Probably it was a department store or something. So he was with his grandfather, and there was a kid. It's not so easy for mothers to go shopping in places like department stores with young children. So the kid, you know, was wreaking havoc, doing something not good. Like he pulled down a whole shelf of something or whatever, and the mother started yelling at the kid, and she started saying, "You're a bad boy." And Rav Palm's grandson said, he turned to his grandfather and he saw his grandfather's crying, and he said, "What's the matter?" He says, "How could she say that to him? To say that he's a bad boy? How could you say that to a child? How could you?" There is an Isser of Anas Dvarim to a child. Now, I don't think she realized that the Anas Dvarim she just committed against Rav Palm. You know, she made Rav Palm cry. Dimasa Matsuya is a violation. You know, so that... What? Yeah, so it's... a person has to be very careful about these, about the way one speaks to children. Yeah.
Also, in regards to Anas Dvarim, doesn't Austin cause a lot of circle around kind of, because you may mean kind of to someone sometimes,
Right, it starts, it escalates. The Torah also warns us not to be mean to orphans or widows, to yesomim and almanos. So there's a machlokes in the Medrash, whether that talks about all people, and the yesomim and almanos are just the most common examples of people who you would take advantage of. Why are they the most common examples of people you would take advantage of? What? We'll get to that in a second. They're the easiest to take advantage of because they have no one to protect them. There's no one to help them. Meaning, they say abusers will always look for people from broken homes or people who don't have, people who don't have a system to protect them, people who don't have a stable home to protect them, and that's who they look for to abuse. So that is a certain type of rishus, a certain level of ona'a. That is that specifically looks for those people, or maybe the Medrash says another day that it's dafka about orphans or widows. But the assumption is that it's the pasuk makes no mention of amisecha in that context. I mean, that would apply whether they are observant, not observant. They're just vulnerable. Just being vulnerable itself makes HaKadosh Baruch Hu want to care for them more. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, "I'm protecting them." They don't have a normal system of people to protect them. HaKadosh Baruch Hu stands in their place. It is interesting to try to figure out what is the definition of a yasom. Let's say, like a 5-year-old child who, Rachman Tzlan, has no parents. So that's obviously a yasom. An 80-year-old man who has no parents, probably not a yasom, right? So where do you draw the line in between?
Parents.
So there would be, you would think the yisra of yeah, okay. All right, I'll tell you a shayla that I was asked. I got a phone call from a guy who serves on a board of a tzedakah organization. This is shayla of the day, you can ask for. Serves on a board of a tzedakah organization that pays for weddings for yisomim. That's the organization's mission, is to pay for weddings for yesomim. So he said, we got an application, and I don't know if we should pay for this wedding or not. So I said, well, is the guy a yesomim? Does he have parents? He said he doesn't have parents. So I said, what's the problem? He said he's 42 years old. So you would think, absolutely pay for the wedding.
I mean, is there anything usher about being married?
Is that from a broken home?
Nothing usher about getting married.
So his parents, no,
his parents died at the age of 80, let's say. And now he doesn't have parents because...
What if he could protect himself if he has a job? You're not going to do it for a yasom if you're rich. It's just pointless.
He probably didn't assume that he was going to get answered.
So the question is, where do you draw the line? At what point do you stop being the nebuch a yasom? You don't say nebuch on a 90-year-old who doesn't have parents. He's not a nebuch. What do you mean? His parents...
Then everyone's yasim.
Right, meaning then at some point everyone's yasim. Okay, that's one approach. I haven't seen that anywhere. The Kaf HaChaim suggests. Kaf HaChaim thinks that by the age of 20 you're not a yasim anymore. For this, Lagabe, this is in the Torah being. Now, Lagabe, the organization, it all depends on what the people who are giving money think. And probably it's anyone who's not old enough to make his own. That, meaning, at whatever age. It would shift from a parent's responsibility to pay for a wedding to a child's responsibility to pay for a wedding. That's probably what the people... So usually I would think, I don't know, but usually I would think that when a 45-year-old gets married, he probably pays for his own wedding. His parents probably don't pay for the wedding at that point. So I would think that in that halacha... Yeah, so the Kaf HaChaim thinks halacha status seems at 20.
Why?
Because at a certain point, it's just... You're an independent person, so you don't. Being a yasom means that you need someone to care for you, and by the time you reach adulthood, the need for someone to care for you is not.
If a kid's a yasom when he gets born, if he's a yasom by then, by the time he's 10 years old, he's already independent.
He's not really. Meaning, I think that's what the Kaf HaChaim is saying, that by the time he's 20 and he's an adult, then he's a little more independent. Yeah, I would think it would be a stage. That's the only person I saw. It's the only post I saw that quantified it. No, I haven't seen it quantified anywhere else. In the Yalkut Me'am Loes, in Parshas Mishpatim, he says that when someone sees somebody else persecuting an orphan or a widow, and he doesn't do anything to stop it, the Torah considers it as if he did it himself. And he says also that if someone persecutes or does an ostvarm on an orphan, it's ki'ilu, you did it to two people. There are two victims, the orphan and the deceased parent who can no longer protect them. It's ki'ilu, you're attacking both. Another major person that requires sensitivity is a ger. The Torah goes out of its way, it says 36 times in the Torah how a ger must be treated with a level of sensitivity. The Chizkuni points out that the warning is necessary because gerim are also easy targets. Why are gerim easy targets? They don't feel like they fit in so well. They don't always fit in so well. They have a different background. They don't know the customs so well. The customs, they don't know the halacha so well either. I took my shir this year on a trip to Scranton, Pennsylvania at the end of the year. Because I was just sort of bored at the end of the year, so I wanted to do something. So we went to Scranton, Pennsylvania to see Shechita. And that's why the other shir whined about it and they got a softball game out of it. But anyway, we went to Scranton, Pennsylvania to see Shechita, and we went to Scranton Wilkes-Barre Yankees game, or Rail Riders game, and in between we had like a couple of hours to do something. So I asked a Talmud of mine who is a resident in a hospital in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and lives there, if he could find us a speaker. I thought maybe he would speak to us. He's a really good guy, Baruch Habitam, and a very inspiring guy. So, but he found us a different speaker. And the speaker that he found for us, knew, who was he? He was a Puerto Rican convert who is now a Satmar Chassid, and happens to be, and for a living, what does he do for a living? He's a violin dealer. So that combination of, you know, of background, I think, like, is probably very... He probably didn't feel so comfortable the first time he davened in the shul in Williamsburg. He probably was, you know, wherever he goes, he's going to stand out. So that's why the Torah warns us about how nice you have to be to a ger, because a ger is always going to... Not everyone's going to stand out that much. The guy was unbelievable, by the way. Right? He was awesome.
He had, like, his face and, like,
yeah, pay is the whole thing. The Bekesha, though.
You look Puerto Rican?
Yes, with a Puerto Rican face and Puerto Rican mannerisms. Yeah, it was accent. Very funny. With the accent,
like,
yeah.
He's trying to talk in Hasidic, but he has a Puerto Rican accent.
We should totally get this guy in the speaking circuit. Like, he should come to Kaylee.
How far is Scranton from here?
It's not that far, actually. From here, it's not that bad.
It's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should. I'll tell Brazil. We should get him as a guest. Wednesday night, you know, one of the weeknights here. We should get him. But he has like a real job. Like, I don't know if he. I asked him if he goes around speaking. He said no. I'm like, why not? he was excellent.
His story
was good.
And his story was good. Yeah, his story was good. And he's just such a tamimistic guy. He's like, he has a real good gayrus also. It's not like one of these like iffy, you know, like Rav Moshe Bick was Magai or him, like big posek in the Satmar community in the Williamsburg, not in Satmar community, in Williamsburg, in Flatbush many, many years ago. Some examples of Anas Tavarim. Should we, want me to stop?
No, keep going.
How many more? Well, I mean, it depends if I go with nicknames or skip nicknames. Should I skip nicknames?
Very relevant.
The Gemara in Bava Metzia, you know, you could leave. Anyone can leave. You don't have to be here. So the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Davin Ches Min Tes, gives a lot of examples of Anas Dvarim, some of which we probably would not have thought of as an Isser without the Gemara. So let's talk about some of them. Nicknames. The Gemara says that there are three people that go to Gehenna and never come out. And that list includes someone who embarrasses somebody else publicly and somebody who refers to his friend by an embarrassing nickname. So, what? What's the reminder? Remember, you got a Gemara?
I know the other. It's different. It's somebody who does arouse, no, not arouse, adultery is one of them. And I think, I'll remember the other one. I know that one is one.
Yeah.
Someone that does adultery.
Okay, let's see. All about Habanas Bechver Barabin. Kol Yardim LeGehenim Olin Chutz Mishlosha. Everyone who goes down to Gehenim comes up except for three. She Yardin Vein Olin. They go down and do not come up. Veiluhein. Habal Eishas Ish. You're right. Someone who commits adultery. Vamalim Pnei Chaver Bram. Someone who embarrasses someone publicly. Vamechana Shem Ra LeChaveru. Says a bad nickname. What? Seen that in embarrassing and publicly. Yes. So.
Was it a thing considered? Like someone calls you by your last name.
Oh, okay, good. In fact, in today's daf?
Yes.
Yesterday's daf? Well, yesterday, we learned yesterday, but it's really today's daf, right? Because we're a day ahead. The Gemara says that you're not the Gemara refers to calling, being Mechana and Chanichaso, and has two Lashonos. Chachinaso, Chanichaso. So one of them means, the Tos says, one of them means calling someone by their last name, and the other one means a nickname. That they're both on some level of. Yeah, does it say that they don't come out of Gehenna? Or is it Moridin Vlomalin, which just means they're going
to
save their lives?
Wants to be called by nickname because it feels like a very embarrassing first name.
Okay, well, we'll talk about it in a second, yeah? Okay, so let's talk. So, yeah? Okay, so we'll get to all these things. So, the Gemara itself distinguishes between embarrassing somebody. Someone just asked, what's the nafkamina between embarrassing someone and calling him a nickname? The Gemara says, because by a nickname, even if it became something that he's used to, but it's fundamentally a shame ra, it's just something that he's used to. Meaning a person got the nickname Tubby or Butch or whatever, you know, something, I don't know, something that because he was fat once or whatever, and now he's thin, and or even if he's not thin, but it's just like everyone came to know him now, or Shorty or whatever, and everyone calls him that because so that's just the way he's called, so he's used to it and he doesn't take offense to it anymore just because his senses have been dulled already over years and years of being called that. So it would still be usher to call him that name. That's a little bit troubling though, because if he doesn't mind, what's the problem? Meaning you call him that and he doesn't mind it, so why do I care that someone else would call it, would think that it's a shame ra if the guy himself doesn't mind it? There's a guy in my shul, sweetest guy in the world, like the nicest guy. One of his things, a lot of times you have like these funny guys that like one of his things is he makes up a nickname for everyone. So like a guy moved into the neighborhood, his name was Moshe Aaron, and he had trouble remembering this fellow's name is Moshe Aaron, but he remembered that it was two of the Ushpizin, so he calls him Ushpizin. You know, so that's his nickname for him, Ushpizin. So, like, is that bad? Is that fundamentally, you know, so Ushpizin's probably not so insulting, but, you know, what if it's something that's fundamentally a shame ra? So there are four explanations that I saw of Daniel Feldman collects in his book as to what the problem is with a nickname, and there are obvious halachic nafkaminas between them. Number one, it could be that calling somebody by a nickname involves inherently disrespecting the person. You would never go to President Obama, regardless of what you think of him, and say, "Hey Barry, what's up?" Because you wouldn't call him by a nickname because he's the president. You would say, "Mr. President," no matter what you actually think of him. So, even okay, I'm saying even if it's objectively, you still wouldn't call him Teddy. Even if it were not an objectively insulting name, because it's just not a dignified manner to speak to a person with. In fact, when people want to project a dignified image, they often use their complete names, first, middle, last. So the more loyal you are to the actual name, the more dignified an image you're trying to project. So when you go, not the full name, but you don't even go the real name, so you're hitting a level of covered up rios that's beneath the threshold of what's acceptable. That's the level of covered rios that we are demanded to expect for each other. A second possible reason is that referring to somebody by a nickname that he's accustomed to may not affect the victim, but it has an effect on the person who's talking, the person who grows accustomed to calling people by names, because that's ultimately going to lead you, meaning maybe it's not ben adam l'chavero, maybe it's ben adam l'atzma. That if you get used to calling people nicknames, ultimately you're going to start violating ben adam l'chaveros also. Ultimately you're going to be the kind of person that doesn't have that same level of respect. So the guy might not mind it, I don't need your respect, it's fine, call me whatever you want. It's like a parent, if a parent were to say, call me by my first name, it's fine. You can't call your parent by their first name. It's not because of them that you can't do it. You can't do that. You need that relationship. It can't be a friend relationship. You need the parent relationship. It needs to be a different kind of relationship. In the Tshuvah Shraga Meir in Chelik Vav Sim Samach Beis, he says perhaps a third reason. They're referring to somebody by a derogatory nickname. Again, even if he's used to it, is a problem because someone else may not know that he's used to it and that he thinks it's okay, and therefore it's a violation of the Yisam Nikiyim. Meaning the halacha is that you're not allowed to do things that make you look. I mean, a lot of times people think, I'll do what I do, and I know what I'm doing is right, so I don't care what other people think about me. I don't care if other people think that I'm a jerk, I'm a rush, I'm a this. We're obligated to care what other people think. There's the Yisam Nikiyim. We have to make sure that we behave in a way that's beyond reproach, that no one would even think that we're doing something wrong. So if we call people by derogatory nicknames, even if they don't mind, and even if it doesn't affect me, but if someone else is going to be choshing me, that then it's my issur. And then a fourth possibility, Rav Daniel Feldman, a friend of mine from YU, is Rosh Shiva there, writes that in his first book, his first English book that he ever published, The Right and the Good, I believe it's called, he has phenomenal, phenomenal books, and Sfarim. He writes that a person's name is his connection to his sense of identity, to his awareness of his own existence as an independent individual. And that's why the names are indicative of a person's character. Rav Meir, the famous story in Yuma Daf Pei Gimel, you know the story where Meir figured out the information about people that he met based on their names, and Rav Yossi didn't do it, so Rav Yossi sort of suffered at the end because the innkeeper that that they stayed by, Rav Yossi wasn't on guard about, and Rav Meir was. Look it up, Yuma Pei Gimel, fascinating story. Exactly. The isser of using a label rather than a name may just mean that is particularly bad when the label is negative. The Mishmur says that once a room, for instance, has been designated as a bathroom, it's not allowed to be used for tefillah, even if it was never actually used as a bathroom. A room designated as a bathhouse can be used for tefillah, as long as it has not yet been used. But the implication of the difference is that the more degrading the designation, the stronger it will stick. Meaning, if you call a place a bathroom, even if you haven't used it as a bathroom, that it's worse than calling a place a bathhouse, even if you haven't used it as a bathhouse. You just call it a bathhouse, we're talking about inanimate objects. You call it a bathhouse, and it doesn't yet have the din of a bathhouse. You call it a bathroom, and it has the din of a beis hakisei. Why? Because an inherently degrading name and designation sticks on something when it's very degrading. So what are the nafkaminas la'alacha? What if you have a benign nickname or a complimentary nickname? A nickname that actually says, Smarty Pants, or Smarty Pants isn't a complimentary, but let's say, the genius, Hagon. Okay. Hagon, meaning if you can refer to someone as a genius. So first of all, you should realize that a lot of times complimentary nicknames do hurt people. People are genuinely humble. This is a good example you just mentioned. It pains them to hear people speak to them that way. So it could actually hurt people even if you're giving a complimentary nickname. There are a lot of people that will say they don't like to hear it, but really secretly are like, good. Stop it, that kind of thing. But there are some people that are so genuinely sincere and humble that it actually hurts them. Tosos Maseches Megillah, the Chav Zayin and Beis, says that it's laudatory behavior to avoid using nicknames altogether, but when the nickname has no derogatory connotation, it's technically halachically permissible. Meaning, Lefnim Mishuras Din, avoid using nicknames. Mishuras Adin, you're really allowed to use nicknames as long as it's not derogatory. Tosim Sech's Tainis and Daf Chaf and Beis assumes that a complimentary nickname would be Mutter. Tosim, right? There's our Daf Yomi coincidence that today's Daf. Tosim says when he talks about the last names, and he says, Avram Ibn Ezra, we're allowed to call Ibn Ezra even though it's a last name because it's a complimentary last name. Now that would only be true if you hold of the middle two reasons of the four that we said, but not if you were to accept the first and the last reasons. I mean, if you assume that it robs a person of a sense of identity, then it doesn't matter what kind of nickname it is. It would automatically rob him of the sense of identity. Now, whether we accept that kula may depend on two texts of Tosus and Nedarim, Daf Beis Amud Aleph, when Tosus talks about the term kinoi, when the Gemara uses the term kinoi to describe a nickname. According to one text, the word means a derogatory name. The other text means a secondary name. So we have two girsos and Tosus in Nedarim. So if it means a derogatory name, so then that's what kinoi is, only if it's derogatory. Secondary name would mean that it would be a violation even if it's not derogatory. Another nafkamina might be, what if it's a descriptive nickname? What would a descriptive nickname be?
Chaim
Aruchim. So the Gemara in Menachos, Daf Lamed Zayin, calls someone Rabbi Yossi Hachorim. And the Rishonim of Machlokas, what does Hachorim mean? How did he get the name Hachorim? So Rashi says, because he had a very big nose, and that was a reference to his big nose. That's what it just means, that he had a big nose. That was his distinguishing characteristic, so that's what they called him by. Tosus says that, no, he came from a place called Chorim, so they called him by where he came from, just like they used to refer to everyone in every yeshiva by the town that they came from, because that's the way they would distinguish. By the jobs, yeah. So Tosus says, Rashi can't be right. Because you can't do that. You can't call someone by their big nose or by their anything else that happens to be, you know, a physical abnormality. So Rashi might say that if there are a lot of people by a certain name, like Yossi, who's apparently a common name, but there are a lot of Yossis also, so a descriptive word to distinguish them is not derogatory, it's just descriptive. So Rashi might say that it's just descriptive. The Shita points out, the Shita Mekvetz in Ksubas Daf Yud Aleph, that if it's the commonly used term Shinina, that refers to people, they say Shinina, you say sharp one. So Rashi always says Shinina means sharp one. Shita says it means people who had big teeth, which apparently is a physical description of their teeth. So he says apparently they held that was mutter. In the Tshuvas Mishnah Binyamin, Simon Chav Gimel, he allows using a descriptive, he allows the Chaim Aruchim. He's the one that says the Chaim Aruchim one. Because it's descriptive more than anything else. In the Tshuva's Torah Lishma, he's asked about giving somebody a nickname that calls attention to a large nose, and he says it really depends on the time and place. If it's considered a negative physical attribute, I mean, there are certain physical attributes that used to not be considered negative. It used to be considered to be positive, to be over, you know, what we would call overweight, to be robust and healthy looking or whatever, and now it's considered, you know, old art. They drew, you know, healthy looking fat people. Now it's considered to be less of a positive thing to describe someone as robust or husky or whatever the, you know, politically correct terminology may be. Rashi in Maseches BaMetzia explains that if you use a nickname that the friend is used to, you're not going to. Rashi says that if you use a nickname that the friend is already used to, is also not going to ascend from Gehenim. And Rashi says, because even though he's used to the name, if you try to embarrass him, it doesn't help. Meaning the implication of Rashi is that it doesn't really matter whether you hurt him. It really depends on your own intention in giving the nickname. So that would fit very well with the Rashi that says, as long as your intention wasn't to hurt him, you're just describing him, so then it would be okay. In the Tshuvas Torah Lishma, the Ben Ish Chai says that two central concerns are the sensitivity of the subject and the intent of the user. You have to focus on both. Is he hurt, and what do I mean by it? Both of those are critical elements to the name calling. That's nicknames. More common form of Anas Tvarim is, skipping around over here, I'll just mention very quickly, reminding people of the past, the Gemara Bavitzia says, is also a form of Anas Dvarim. Telling the children of Gerim, oh wow, your parents used to, whatever. You know, there's a guy in Boca, a guy who lives in Boca Raton, Florida, he's a doctor, who is a Ger, and he's a child of his father was a Nazi. This guy was born in Germany. He spoke where? Oh, really? It's unbelievable, no? His story is incredible. And he actually is recorded. He's on YU Torah. I forgot his name. He wrote a book. But he described how when he was a kid, his father never really spoke about the war. He knew his father was in the army, but he didn't know anything about it. And he just knew that it was like a sore topic. And then he started learning in school a little bit about the Holocaust. And he started asking questions. And he started realizing that his father was a monster, that his father had killed thousands of Jews, and he just couldn't stomach it. He ran away from home, and he had a teacher that he trusted, and that was, he was getting information from, was educating him. The father got angry at the teacher. How could you teach my kid about this stuff? You know, it never happened, kind of thing. You know, we're just trying to push it under the rug. And he ran away from home, and he ran to a Jewish community to learn more about the Jews, because he felt like he wanted to connect in some way. And he became a Shabbos guy for the Jewish community there for a while, and then ultimately he converted. He became a ger, and he got married, and he had children, and he never told his children, his wife he told, but he never told his children what his background was. And his child was, I think he said his kid was like 14 years old, and his kid said to him, just out of nowhere one day, "Who's my grandfather? How come I never met my grandparents?" And he said, "Well, sit down." And he told him. And the kid had an assignment in school, like that week, write about your family lineage, you know, about your heritage. And the kid wrote his whole essay about my grandfather killed thousands of Jews in the Holocaust and whatever. And the principal called the father up and said, "You need to come into the office. Your son wrote this horrible thing, where he's disrespecting the school and your family or whatever by saying, making up this crazy story about his grandfather." And the father's like, "Well, actually, it's not a crazy story, it's actually the truth." And the principal's like, "What? Do you speak about this publicly?" He said, "Never did." He said, "Well, you need to. You know, people should hear this story. This is a remarkable story." Now, to go over to that kid and say, "Wow, your grandfather's murdering," whatever, you know, so that would be a violation of Anas Dvarim. Now, it's interesting, when the Gemara says it, it says to speak to the children of Gerim about what their parents did. It doesn't say to speak to Gerim about what they did. It doesn't say you shouldn't go to a Ger and say to the Ger, you used to eat lobster or whatever. It doesn't say to do that. That's an issue. It could be, the reason it doesn't say that is because in many respects that might be a compliment, that you were tam tam di isura, and look at the kochos and nefesh that you had to be able to change your entire life around. So it may not be an insult to say something like that, depending on what. I mean, you're going to say that you came from that and you still managed to become... But he didn't make it right. He's a child of Gerim. So that's also suggested by Poskim. Yeah? So it depends how comfortable he is with it. Sometimes they don't, you know, it's like hurtful for them to talk about it. And if that's the case, then that's the problem. You know, sometimes they like to talk about it, you know. There's a Rebbe in DRS who's a Baal Tshuva, who... Rabbi Yudin was Makari of his family, from Fairlawn, New Jersey, and he spoke at a DRS Shabbaton about it, and he was saying how I think he said cheeseburgers. He said, "Oh, shrimp." There's like one food that he's like that I really miss. Rabbi Yudin was Makari of his family, the Rebbe's family.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Gemara discusses telling the Baal Tshuva himself of what he had done, and the child of a ger. It's different. But the Baal Tshuva says talk about him. And the Marsha says that again, because when you talk to a ger, it could be taken in a positive way, that look what he's, how he changed his life from becoming a ger, but it wasn't an avera when he was a ger. Meaning, so you're not talking about something that he had done badly. It's just, it's totally empowering. Look, you used to be someone who didn't have this kedusha soul. You accepted kedusha soul, whereas a Baal Tshuva had done averos. So to remind someone of averos that they actually did, it's also important to realize averos that we've just taken from our own perspective. Averos that we've done in the past should be hurtful to us. Meaning, if it's hurtful, if it's supposed to be hurtful to tell a Baal Tshuva about his past averos, the flip side of that is, it should be hurtful for us to recall our past averos. It bothers me sometimes where you have people my age even, who are very firm, wonderful people, but speak like longingly about like the time in high school when they did X, Y, or Z that are like blatant isurim. That should not be something that we, you know, speak about it in any positive way whatsoever. things that we've done wrong, it should be hurtful for us to speak about. It should be something that, you know, we feel terribly about. If not, if that's not the way we think about it, then we haven't done tshuva. We may not do it anymore, but we haven't really done tshuva, because part of the basic fundamental level of tshuva is charata alava. It's not real charata if you speak about it, you know, like it was something great and something fun and enjoyable. Another form of anas dvarim, the Gemara Bamitzia tells us, is if you share your opinion on why someone is suffering. You'll see this at shiva houses sometimes, and it's remarkable that people still haven't gotten this memo that you're not supposed to talk like this at a shiva house. But sometimes at a shiva house, someone will have tragically died, and they'll say, "Oh, that's what happens when you don't dress the tzniyas dick." You know, like,
who would say that? Whole video is like a
10-minute. Right. It's stuff people say at shiva houses. Yeah. My kids know that video by heart. Excuse me a second. Mazel tov, right? That one.
Imagine, okay. Imagine always the number. Yeah.
Okay. We don't need to go through the whole thing now. The Gemara identifies the friends of Eov as having violated this form of anas dvarim because they speculated why Eov suffered. The Gemara says that. Now, we do believe in schar v'onesh. It's an important balance. We believe that we get punished for our avodos and we get rewarded for our mitzvos, but we don't believe that we know the cheshbon. That's the difference. The Yaakov Baruch Hu does have a cheshbon. We just don't believe we know exactly what the cheshbon is. When bad things happen, Soloveitchik famously said, our question is not why, our question is what. I mean, it's not why did this happen, it's what should I do now to make, you know, to improve on my Shmiras and Mitzvahs dedication to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so that we can enhance our relationships with the Ribbono Shel Olam going forward. Not because I know that the area that I'm going to choose to fix was the reason of the Avera, it was the reason for the punishment plan. Just that it's a wake-up call on some level. Cheshbon HaNefesh needs to be done, but not in the sense of playing prophet. The Gemara in Brachos Daf Hey says there was a story that seems to contradict this. The Gemara says Rav Huna had a massive supply of wine that spoiled, and the Rabbanan came to him and said that he should try to figure out which Avera it was that he did that caused Hashem to make his wine spoil. So they insisted that it has to be a sin that you did that caused this to happen, because Hashem doesn't punish somebody for no reason. So as it turns out, he realized that he didn't pay his wages, the wages to his workers, to his sharecroppers properly, and that was the sin that caused the wine to spoil. So apparently the Rabbanan had no hesitation to go over to him and say, "You sinned! What was it? You're a sinner! What was the sin that you did?" So, seems in direct contrast to what it says in Bava Metzia. So the Malbim writes that there's no contradiction. Tosfos in Maseches Brachos suggests when the Rabban came over to him, they suggest Rav Huna was being punished for something that he had done, it's because they had specific knowledge of a particular sin that he needed to fix. They knew that he wasn't paying his workers. A lot of great people who had never sinned suffered from all sorts of difficulties, and there's no explanation for that. But when there is an obvious explanation, now notice what they did. They didn't say, "You did this," and therefore, because you don't tell it. Do a cheshbon nefesh. They encouraged him to do a cheshbon nefesh, and Malm explains only because they saw Pesach for it. Right. So there's a difference between telling someone that they have done something wrong and telling them that they have suffered because of that. That their suffering is a result of that.
Wrong.
What?
They knew what he did wrong. Why would they do?
Maybe they felt it wasn't necessary to do it in a direct way over here because he couldn't come to the recognition on his own.
Even if they saw that both things, they saw that they paid the wages for it and they saw this one spoiled, how would they know that it's like real
parish? That's a good, yeah, the Malbim's a little troubling. Yeah, that's a good kasha. Another classic example the Gemara gives of anas dvarim is going into a store without any intention to buy something and just looking around as if you're planning on buying something. That's a violation of anas dvarim. Now, there are different types of stores. There are certain stores that are like a thing to see. Like, I don't know if it still exists. There used to be a toy store called FAO Schwartz. Oh, yeah, where they had all these. Does it still exist? They have all these cool toys in the city. A lot of people go there. When my parents used to take us there as kids, they used to say, "We're going to the F.E.O. Schwartz Museum." Like, we didn't even know it was a toy store. They told us that it was a museum. Like, we had no idea that you can actually buy things there. So, if it's... Because it's very expensive. So if it's something that there's no real expectation that you can buy, and people just generally go there all the time without any intent to buy something, that's just part of the experience, then that's okay. The Rav Shonim give two reasons for this issue. The Meiri says that in an attempt to explain to the storekeeper why you're not making the purchase, you might say something like, "You know, I'm not going to buy this, it's just not worth it for me," which seems to be a harmless comment, but if someone else hears you say it's not worth it, well, why should I buy it if it's not worth it? I mean, it may discourage other people. So the conversation in explaining, "No, I'm just looking, I'm not really, I don't really think this stuff is so nice," or like, "You know, I don't want to spend this kind of money, I'll just buy it on Amazon." You know, if you say things like that, it may give other people the same idea. The Rashbam adds that the very act of looking around usually involves picking items up, inspecting them, and in general, wear and tear on an item happens very slowly. It may be less than a shavu pruta of damage that you do just by moving it around and whatever, but you're manipulating and holding something that doesn't belong to you, or something that you have no intention of buying. The reason the store allows you to touch things is because they hope that that will encourage you to buy something. But if you have zero intention of buying anything, then that would not work. Now, according to both shittos, the issue is not only in getting his hopes up that you're going to buy something, but it's an actual monetary damage that you might cause him by looking around in the store. If you're really interested in buying something, but you want to just see as many places as possible so you can find the cheapest price, and you don't know which store is going to have the cheapest price, so you go from one store to another, so that would seem to be no problem at all. The most common example of this type of an astron is if you already bought something from a different store, but you want to inquire about the price to determine whether you got a good deal. I mean, you already got it, so you're not buying it again. You just want to know if you got a good deal or not. So you go into the store, "Oh, I just want to check." You know, like that would be this form of anas tvarim. People do this now. It's more common. People who, let's say, they want to buy shoes on, what's the website? Zappos, right? But they don't want to buy shoes without seeing it in person, trying it out. So they'll go to a local shoe store, and they'll try on the new shoes or whatever, the new LeBrons or whatever. I just saw there was a counselor yesterday wearing a referee's shirt, and a couple of kids came over to him and said, "Excuse me, do you have new LeBrons in? Is that here? Is that
so?"
like he's a Foot Locker guy. Yeah. So you go to the store, you inspect the shoe, you try it on, and then you go back and you order it in Zappos. So that's a form of an anas tvarim. Or anything, whenever you want to order anything on what? Ooh, so that would be big enough to mean about non-Jews. Oh. Right, if non-Jews are not included in those tvarim, that's very interesting. But you're not allowed to steal money from non-Jews. So in terms of the Malbim's explanation and the Rashbam's explanation, if you're causing a monetary loss through anas tvarim by holding it and trying it on, and so that even though it's a very tiny monetary loss, that could be that it would still be aser. The Gemara in Bava Metzia suggests telling somebody to look to buy an item at a place where the item is not available is a form of anas tvarim. So the Kesef Mishnah explains the storekeeper who doesn't have the item in stock is going to be embarrassed. Like, guy's like, "Where do I get this?" And you just want to drive the guy crazy. So you're like, "Go to that store, ask them if they have it." And you know that they don't have it. So he's going to ask, and they're going to say, "Oh, sorry, we don't carry that." Storekeeper feels terrible when you ask for something and they don't have it, because like he had his hopes up that he'd be able to make a sale, and now he feels like his store doesn't carry a sufficient stock of whatever it is. A very common example of this would be suggesting a shidduch or a job that you know is not going to work. He's not going to. Someone's nagging you. Find a shidduch for my daughter. Find a shidduch for my daughter. Find a shidduch for my daughter. So you're just like, okay, you know, try that guy, and you know it's just not going to. So people a lot of times will justify that the girl or the boy is struggling so much with this difficulty of finding a date, so you just want to give them a date so that you raise their spirits momentarily. But the falsehood and the ultimate hurt by being turned down outweighs any temporary comfort and joy, probably. Yeah, it's Kneva Stas as well. It's another overlapping, yeah. Another form of Nasva. Yeah, that happens also. My wife and I have made two shidduchim. My wife has made three. I've made two. Together, we've made two shidduchim. Well, she's made three. Right? One of them is it was a situation where someone called me up and said, "Can you arrange this shidduch?" I thought of an idea. This guy, this girl, but I don't really know either of them, and you know both of them well. Can you arrange it? I'm like, terrible idea. They're like, arrange it anyway. I'm like, I don't think this is going to work. I'll arrange it anyway. Like, okay, fine. So I arranged it, and they got married. And like, you know, and they were so thankful or whatever. I'm like, you know, I'm very bad at this. I'm just not like good at, you know, predicting what's going to work. Yeah, so that both of mine were like that, actually. I felt both of them were bad ideas, and I was just like forced into doing it. The Medrash records that as Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Shmuel were being taken out to be killed, Rabbi Shimon lamented that he didn't understand why he was suffering as bad as he was. And Rabbi Shmuel said, maybe someone came to ask you a shaila once, and you made the person wait while you took a drink or while you tied your shoes or whatever. And causing someone distress, even very tiny distress, such as waiting, just waiting a little bit, is apparently some sort of iser. So it's this medrash apparently teaches us, first of all, that it's an issue to cause someone to needlessly wait even for a small amount of time. Doctors suffer from this sometimes, that if their office is not run in an efficient manner, they cause people to needlessly wait a long time in the waiting room. The Gemara considers it inappropriate to suggest that someone is suffering because of specific averus that they've done. But apparently, if the victim asks for help, that's okay. Meaning, that's the other thing you have in this Gemara. Rabbi Shimon says to Rabbi Shmuel, I'm trying to figure it out. Can you help me figure out what I might have done? That's what he came up with, which tells you a little something about Rabbi Shimon that is pretty special. The last example is the Aruch HaShulchan says that you're not supposed to draw attention to someone's physical shortcomings or any other shortcomings a person might have, even if you're not going to talk about them. For example, if there's someone who struggles with their diets and they're overweight or whatever, don't talk about how great your diet is and how it's working for you in front of them. If there's someone that that's bald, don't talk about, you know, the greatest hairstyles. If there's someone, and this is a big one, if there's someone, there's a couple that's struggling to have children, don't spend the whole Shabbos meal talking about how great your kids are and, you know, chinuch choices or whatever. Don't talk about things that are going to draw attention to what someone doesn't have. The Rambam considers asking somebody about a topic that they're ignorant in to be a form of anas dvarim. I'm going to ask you about something that I know you don't know. That's a form of anas dvarim. The Yor Samech points to a Gemara Bab Metzia, Daf Pei Aleph, as the source for that Rambam. The Gemara says, Rabbi Shimon ben Eliyakim asked Rabbi Elazar about a halacha that had gone unexplained for years, and Rabbi Elazar took offense to the question because he assumed that the guy was trying to embarrass him. Rav Shechter tells the Maisa where someone came over to Rav Moshe at a chasen and asked him a shaila, and Rav Moshe immediately answered, it was a prima gadim, and he immediately answered the prima gadim, and the guy walked away, and Rav Moshe turned to the person sitting next to him and he said, the guy thought he was going to chop me on enough in a prima gadim, meaning Rav Moshe assumed the person was asking the shaila to try to chop him, to try to, because he thought that Rav Moshe wouldn't know. But the most remarkable part of the story is that Rav Moshe said, like, how could he think he would chop me on enough in a prima gadim? I don't know if you've ever seen prima gadims. It's like, it's a commentary on the commentaries of Shulchan Aruch in very, very tiny print, and they're very, very long. And Rav Moshe knew, like, all of prima gadim bal peh. Like, you know, how could he ever have a havamin that he's going to chop me on a certain type of Talmud Chacham that we're not used to, that we don't see. I told you the story of Ruchaim Kanievsky, and Rabbi Razin told me the other day. Did I tell it just to a couple of you? I told it just to a couple of you, right? I'll tell the story again. Rabbi Razin told me that he heard from Rav David Cohn, I think, that, or he heard from someone, that Rav David Cohn from Brooklyn, big posik in Brooklyn, had put together a list of Rambams that he couldn't find any makor for, where the Rambam got, you know, where the Rambam took these halachas from. So he wrote down the list, however many it was, like 15 Rambams that he couldn't find any makor for whatsoever. And he was talking to Rav Simcha Cook once, and he said to Rav Simcha Cook, next time you're by Rav Chaim Kanievsky, can you hand him this list and ask him if he knows of the makoros of any of these Rambams? It was a list of just Hilchos Tmidim Safin Perek Vav Halachaba. Hilchas this didn't even say what the Ram said, just a list of, you know, where it was. And Simcha Cook hands of Chaim Kanievsky the list. Chaim Kanievsky says, give me a pen, and he just starts writing out, you know, next to each one, the exact marker of where each one comes from, just like that, just like without thinking. He didn't even look up the Rambams. So not only did he know the marker of every single one of the Rambams, he didn't even have to look up where the kind of Talmud Chacham that it takes. It's like we can't really relate well to like what that even means. The Gemara has some very, very nasty things to say about someone who commits on us, Devarim. The Gemara Baba Kama Kuf Yud Zayin says that when Rabbi Yochanan came to Yeshiva, Rav Kahana didn't ask any questions. When Rav Kahana came to Rav Yochanan's Yeshiva, Rav Kahana didn't ask any questions. But once he started asking questions, his questions weren't really answered. So when Rav Yochanan failed to be able to answer several questions, and he looked up with his big eyebrows, he picked up his eyebrows and he looked up, he thought he saw Rav Kahana smirking. And he misinterpreted it. He thought it was a smirk. It wasn't really. And he thought that Rav Kahana was taking pride in the fact that he made Rabbi Yochanan look like a fool. So Rabbi Yochanan's feelings were hurt, and God immediately caused Rav Kahana to die. So apparently, even the impression of Anas Devarim is something that could be devastating. The Gemara Bava Tzia Daf Lamed Gimel says Rav Chisson and Rav Huna each spent 40 days fasting to be mechaper for inadvertently insulting each other. 40 days fasting for inadvertently insulting each other. Apparently, they thought it was a bad enough avera that that's what they had to do. The Gemara Basra Daf Chav Beis has a machlokas between different Amorayim as to what led to Rav Adu Bar Abba's death. Rav Dimi said that Rav Adu was punished for insulting him about his level of Torah knowledge. And Rava suggested that he had died because of disrespect that he gave Rava. I mean, each one was saying, oh, I know why he died. He insulted me. I know why he died. No, he insulted me. And Abaye says that he died because of the unflattering way that he used to describe Abaye's shiurim. So each one said, I felt hurt by him. And they all attributed his death to Anas Devarim of some form or another. The Chassam Sofer has a fascinating tshuva in Chelek Hei, Chosh Mishpatsim, Kuf Ayin Vav. He was asked about a case where a shochet had informed a mohel. The fact that it was shochet isn't really irrelevant. But he informed the mohel that his wife had given birth to a baby boy and asked the mohel to come do the bris on his new son. So the mohel always wants to do the mitzvah. And if you know mohelim, they will go to the ends of the earth to do a milah because they take it as like a holy endeavor that this is. So if they have to walk 5 miles on Shabbos to go do a bris milah in the neighboring town, a lot of mohelim will be moser nefesh, the moser leva nefesh to do it. And the mohel was not even slated to be paid for his services, and he traveled for 4 hours on the day to do the bris milah, and he got there. And it turned out that the shochet had played a practical joke on him. The baby was a girl. Ha ha, you came all this way. Funny. So everybody there got a good laugh out of it. And they thought that the mohel, it was really funny that the mohel came to do a bris and it turned out it was a baby girl. But the mohel didn't think it was very funny. And the Chassam Sofer said that the shochet should lose his job. He shouldn't be a shochet anymore. He shouldn't be allowed to be a shochet anymore. Can't trust someone like that with Shechita. Pretty significant. I mean, willing to take away his livelihood because he had done a practical joke, which is also a form of Ona'as Devarim. One of the more common motivations of people who speak hurtfully about others is to raise their own self-esteem by putting other people down. Rabbi Daniel Feldman tells the story of Yisrael Salant, who describes a rabbi meeting two children who are arguing, and the subject of their argument was which of the two boys was taller. So one child pushed the other one to the ground and, standing over him, said, "Now I'm taller." The other kid was on the ground. So Yisrael helped the defeated child off the ground and said to the one who pushed him, "You didn't have to push him to the ground to prove that you were taller. All you had to do was stand on a box." And the message that he was trying to say is, of all the forms of Anas Devarim, putting people down as a method of raising yourself up is a particularly heinous form of Anas Devarim. The Talmud Yerushalmi, as quoted in the Rambam, the sixth part of Hilchos Deos, says that someone who gets honored by putting someone else down has ein lo chelek le'olam haba, has no chelek in olam haba. It's interesting that it doesn't appear in the Bavli's list of people who have no chelek in olam haba. The Sanhedrin Daf Tzadi in Perchelik, we have a list of who doesn't have Chelik in Olam Haba. In fact, the Bavli says that Rabbi Mechunya ben Akana thought that he lived a long life because he never respected himself, he never raised himself up at the expense of someone else, which makes it sound like it's a midas chasidus, but it's, so one would be inclined to say that it must be machlokas bavli and Yerushalmi, whether it's technically an isser or it's just a midas chasidus, but maybe the Yerushalmi means to say that the loss of the Olam Haba is when you do this constantly, habitually, or intentionally. Well, the Bavli maybe is talking about someone who maybe does it unintentionally, you know, every once in a while. You didn't realize that you were putting someone else down and you were gaining respect for it. That goes back to the VRS and Elkacha discussion. I have nothing else to say about Anas Tavarim other than we should be very careful not to do it, and we should be inspired by the camp that we're in, to always show respect to everybody.